All right, members and members of the audience, this committee meeting will come to order. We have several bills on the agenda today, and we'll run through those as briefly but efficiently as we can today. The first bill before us is Representative Dabney's. Representative Dabney? Do you have a panel of witnesses?
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, committee.
Representative Dabney, would you care to move your bill, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would. I'd like to move House File 3685 to be brought before the committee for possible inclusion in whatever omnibus bill we may do.
All right. Representative, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, you have before you a Minneapolis legislator representing a growing statewide problem, adequately funding English language learner services. In 2003, the legislature capped ELL funding at 5 years of funding per student retroactively without regard to student background, student proficiency, or the increasing academic English standards that we're asking these students to achieve. This has created either a loss of support for students in districts, or in many districts, a growing cross-subsidy from regular education programs to English language learner programs. This bill simply returns us to pre-2003 funding levels and statute language. I have with me today, Madam Chair and members, two individuals who will be testifying, but there are a number of others in the audience who are here with great interest in this bill. I'd ask them to stand at this time. That's even more than I'd expected. I do know that we have representatives from both the traditional public schools and charter schools here today. We have instructors, administrators, and students for our VLL programs, including Stillwater, Hope Academy, Minneapolis, Anoka Hennepin, North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, St. James, St. Paul, and others. With that, Madam Chair, I thank you all very much. With that, Madam Chair, I would like to ask my first testifier, Dr. Stephen Krashen, Professor Emeritus from the University of Southern California, to talk to us about the issues related to ELL education.
All right, Professor. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I hope you have in front of you a handout that I prepared called How Long Does It Take? I've been asked to try to give you an idea of how long it generally takes students throughout the country until they reach what's called redesignation. Redesignation means you're fully proficient, you're ready to do the entire curriculum in English. The punchline of all this is that it takes a long time. Before they reach redesignation, students usually, after a few years, know enough English to do at least part of this curriculum in English. So we're going to talk about the gold standard, how long it takes to be fully proficient so you can do the whole thing. I have data from you that I'll go through very quickly from three states, California, Arizona, Massachusetts. All three states have passed initiatives dismantling bilingual education. So this is what you get under English immersion. Take a look at California. California, they give all the students a test. It's called the CELT test. It has five levels. You got to reach the top level before you're eligible to be reclassified. This is the average gain students make in 1 year. In each year, they make less than 1 year's gain on the average. This projects redesignation time at least 5 years, probably a lot longer. We have more concrete data from Table 2. And here, if you're an underliner or a circler, pay attention to Grade 5, the numbers down at the bottom. How many children, what percentage of children have acquired English fully proficient by grade 5? Look at this, cohorts, about 30%, 32%, 32%. Arizona has a test, an oral test of five levels or six levels, depending on which one. You got to reach the top level or the top two levels before you're eligible for reclassification. How are they doing? Look at the line in table 3 that says 0. And you see that most of the kids make no gains at all. The few who do make gains go up about a level a year. So again, we're seeing an average of less than one level a year. Massachusetts, the third state that Dumped Bilingual Education has provided us with data, here in table 4, the last column is the one that counts. After 3 years of being in the program, how many have reached the top level where they're even eligible to be reclassified? About 50%. What we get here, very consistent state after state, it takes a long time. Even under reasonably favorable conditions, these are not children who've been in refugee camps. These are not children suffering from malnutrition. They're not wealthy children, but they're not at the lowest levels of poverty all the time. It takes a while. It takes a long time. An important point I have to make, since I've given a platform here, is to talk about the impact of poverty on all this. If you'll flip your paper over, you will see that the influence of poverty, what we call social class, is absolutely overwhelming. The top chart is from California. We have it by ethnic group, but the chart that really counts, the column that really counts, is years of parental education. The children who come from families that are highly educated go through at more than double the rate of the one of the lowest ones. Nobody's going through very quickly, but if your parents are educated, it means a lot. And we have data from this all over the country, wherever this has been looked at. High poverty is reclassified much more rapidly. More kids are reclassified much faster than low poverty children. Now, I've called high social class de facto bilingual education. The children have all the advantages. They have a lot going for them. They have help at home with homework, with parents they can understand. They have parents who know schoolwork. Most important, and this transcends any specific program, they have access to books. I think one of the most profound results coming out of all educational research in the last few years is the difference between rich and poor in access to books. The data is staggering. Children who are from wealthy areas are deluged with books. Children from poor areas have practically nothing. We did a study back in California comparing Watts and Beverly Hills. Can you imagine? The average child in Beverly Hills we talked to, had about 200 books of their own at home, which is not, you know, crazy. I had that many. My adorable grandson, 3 years old, has nearly that many already. In Watts, less than 1.4. School is not leveling the playing field. School is making it worse. We looked at classroom libraries. The kids in Beverly Hills averaged 400 books in their classroom libraries. In Watts, 50. The school libraries are better, more books in the home. Far better bookstores everywhere. The poor neighborhoods, basically drugstores, nothing for the children older than 7. Limited English proficient children are, by and large, children of poverty. My suggestion on all this is that we not worry too much about timing kids and putting restrictions, but worry a lot more on providing help where it's needed, where we can really make an impact. And the first step, before we discuss programs, time, funding, let's make sure that children have access to books and a lot of it. The analogy I like to use is this. You're driving down the freeway and you get a flat tire and you pull over, and another person pulls up behind you, and instead of helping you change the flat tire, he takes out a stopwatch to time you and see how fast you can do it, urging you to go faster. I say no, let's help people change the tire. Those are my comments.
Thank you. We really don't applaud and yell and things like that in here. So thank you very much for just being quiet and observing the process. Your next witness, please, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Next witness is Ms. Valeria Silva from the St. Paul Schools.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to come to talk to you about what are we doing in St. Paul and how is it changing. I am the Director of English Language Learners for St. Paul Schools. I have been in this job for 8 years, amazingly enough. I mean, it has had a lot of challenges, but a lot of them have been very rewarding. I tell you why St. Paul is different and what Minnesota is different from other countries, other states. And I tell you the most important part is Minnesota, every school district who has English language learner students have at least between 50 to 70 different languages in their system. Most of the schools do not have a chance to buy anything closely to meet the needs language-based to all the kids because of funding. But we also have, in our school population, as Dr. Krashen said, 78% of our English language learners in St. Paul are from poverty level. And the majority of those students, parents do not have a higher education than in the 12th grade, especially the new group that we just received in the last 18 months. We received 2,250 students that they entered the St. Paul schools in the last 18 months who came from the refugee camp. And as Dr. Preston told you, the refugee camp does not mean that they have much education. Most of the students live in very poor condition. That is very different from a student that comes from another country to study English here and their parents are working in 3M. We do not have that kind of population in our system. But even though with all those issues, 43% of our students are second language learners, we have been able to make a difference. And I tell you very proudly, the level of performance of our students in St. Paul, ELL students, are the first in the nation, and you've got some data in front of you. Not only we are able to outperform the state level ELL for all the other school districts, but also we're doing it nationally. Why? Why are we doing this? Why our students are doing what they're doing? Well, because we have created some innovative models for providing instruction to the students, but it requires funding. 3 years ago, you or someone else who was in your chair made some changes on the law. The ADM was 5 years and impacted St. Paul schools. 48% of the ELL funding changed at that time. So we lost 48% of our funding because of that. I'll give you an example right now, very, very close to it. Here is a little girl called Mai, who is one of my favorite students. She's in fourth grade in one of the East Side schools in St. Paul. She entered kindergarten. She went 3 years consecutively to summer school. Then she went to after-school program. The parents want the student to be accessing to education as much as she could. When she enters fourth grade, by the end of the December time, Mai did not have any way to provide any funding to our system anymore because her 5 years were up. Because the way the ADM is presented is summer school and after school program. And by the middle of fourth grade, Mai still hasn't caught up with her peers because she started speaking 300 words of English compared to a middle class child who started 10,000 words of English. That is a very big gap. Well, St. Paul, as a district, has been able to also provide 40% of the ELL funding that we have comes from our district funding. But every year our district funding has also diminished. And the transition of dollars have helped us. The transition of dollars that we had 3 years ago, 4 years ago, are not the same dollars we have today. The cost of living have changed tremendously. I'll give you one more example and I will be done. When we looked at a school as Sheridan, 4 years, 3 years ago, Sheridan Elementary School has 202 students. They had 3 ELL teachers and 2.5 EA. Today, with the same number of students, they have 1.6 teachers and 0.75 EA. I called the principal because she called me desperately on Friday after I sent her the allocation for next year. And I said to her, she said to me, what do you want me to do? Should I tell the parents that their children can only get sick on Thursdays and Tuesdays if they speak Mon and if they speak Spanish on Monday and Wednesday because I only can have a 0.35 ELL EA who supports them there in the language needs? No, it cannot happen. Arlington has 1,050 students, and all that data is in your paper. They get, with the funding, because of the ADM, they get 3 ELL teachers and 1 bilingual EA. In that building alone, we have 62 languages spoken in that building. So how a principal can do that? Logically, our district has provided funding in addition to the funding that we get from the state to provide the instruction. And because of what we have done, look at the test scores we're doing. So you asked us 3 years ago, show us the performance. We're showing you the performance. We're the leading in the state right now for ELL in the nation. And we look at this money and I don't know how else can I cut and continue cutting every year. I just finished sending the allocation to the schools. I have over 300 staff in my school. 25 people will lose the job. And it's not about losing the job. It's an opportunity to work with the schools and kids. When I look at it, in the year 2002, I used to have 157 bilingual EAs that work in the school supporting the families. At this point, just the budget I sent, it was an 81.75. This is an incredible issue. Our families cannot connect to school if we don't have the funding. That is the situation we're facing. So I plead with you. We have showing results. The kids are making tremendous gains. We need to make sure to go back and look at what we did in 2003 or 2002 and how that impacted us. Saint Paul alum, again, I'm going to say, lost 48% of the funding. I know other school districts that they're all around the state lost a big amount too. So it's not just the Saint Paul or Minneapolis issue. And as you see, a lot of other school districts are feeling the same situation. Our first ring of suburbs are in getting a lot of ELL students because they're moving up to there, as well as the small school districts across the state. Thank you very much. And if you need any more data or information, I'll be happy to provide that for you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Silva. We have a little time for questions. Are there any questions of the people who have given testimony here? Hearing none, thank you very much for your testimony, and 3685 will be laid over for possible consideration in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
All right, we'll move along to House File 3223. We'll wait a minute while the room empties out somewhat. And then if, is Representative Dorman in the room? Is Representative Dorman here anyplace? This seems familiar. All right, we will move on to Representative Greiling's House File 3903. And Representative Greiling, you may move your own bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I move House File 3903 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill is a bill to continue funding the Scholars of Distinction program, which is a program like AP and IB that is of benefit to our most gifted and talented students, and it's a program that I believe has been meeting the needs of a lot of students for relatively little cost. But yet it is slated for extinction at the end of this funding year. So to speak to this bill, I have with me Karen Newell, to my left from the Intermediate 287 School District, where she's in charge of academic services and also the project leader for the Scholars of Distinction program. And then to her left, who will speak after Ms. Newell, is, and listen carefully, members, to the name of this student, because it might be familiar to you.
And he'll be a senator.
And he might be a senator someday, or start out as a House member. His name is Yahya Chaudhry. So first, Madam Chair, we'll start with Ms. Newell.
Welcome, Ms. Newell. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative. The Scholar of Distinction program actually had its beginning in 1995 when the Profiles of Learning were created. The basic standards for students, high standards for students were created, and then provision was made at that time for standards of distinction for those students who are achieving heads and shoulders and at very sophisticated levels above what is called for in the high school or in the standards. At that time, four areas were announced for development. They were mathematics, science, theater arts, and applied geography. If you're looking at a brochure now, I think the pages are passing them. Historically, those were the four. Task forces were funded at that time, and work was begun. Two of the areas went out and found support among foundations and in the community to actually begin the work recommended by the task forces. That was the Scholars of Distinction in Applied Geography, which was funded by the National Geographic Society, and the Scholars of Distinction in Science, which was funded by 3M and Medtronic Benevolence. They continued for several years, and we came to the legislature 2 years ago to ask for continued funding, and were given funding to move forward with the task forces that hadn't begun, and that was theater arts and mathematics. The task force work and all their recommendations were there, but none of the work had begun. At that time, Senator Steve Kelly suggested that leadership be added, and we did so. And during this past academic year, all of the areas are up and functioning and working. We are preparing to make awards this spring in the areas of mathematics, science, theater arts, and in those three areas, there are no applicants this year in the area of applied geography because of the changes in the standards. That committee has stepped back and need to rethink its mission, and they are currently doing that under the leadership of David Lanigren at McAllister. Leadership is ready next week to begin the kickoff for the awards for the next academic year. We are hosting at Intermediate District 287 a leadership summit, calling representative students from all of the congressional districts, and we are going to be meeting with 50 students and their advisors next week to begin work on implementing the actual leadership awards. So we are most excited about this, and frankly, we are making promises to students to carry out in the carrying out of our tasks this year that we are not sure we're going to be able to keep because funding has not been allocated for the continuation of this program. I want to say one thing about why this program, why Scholars of Distinction. The legislatures have recognized the importance of international baccalaureate programs and advanced placement programs, but frankly, we have students in all parts of the state who don't have access to those programs, and yet are achieving incredible work above and beyond what the high school standards call for. And that, I think, is one of the most important things. It is a leveling of the playing field in Minnesota for our very top gifted and talented students in the areas that we are awarding. And this award enables us to encourage students to continue excellence and challenging work in the areas of their choosing. And our program is one of self-nomination. I can use particularly science because that's probably one of the longer running programs. Students self-nominate for this award. It's all done electronically. There are no boundaries. It's not for just kids in the metro area. Students from anywhere in Minnesota can nominate themselves through our partner, the Minnesota Academy of Science. And they proceed to meet the requirements and show the excellence of their work. Their work is adjudicated by various members of the community, the science community, citizen scientists, as well as educators. And I would like to introduce to you a young man from Bloomington Kennedy High School. This is Yahya Chaudhry. He's a senior this year and will not qualify for the Scholar of Distinction and Leadership Award, but he has been serving over the last 3 or 4 months as a member of our Student Advisory Committee. And I would like to introduce Yahya Chaudhry to you.
Mr. Chaudhry, can you wait just a minute? We do have someone with a question. Representative Klensing, I believe you had a question for Ms. Newell.
I do. Ms. Newell, I was wondering what the $300,000 is spent on. Like, how's the budget broken down?
I have a copy of that here. It has been spent, first of all, to have a coordinator in each of the areas. In most cases, it was a member of the original task force in that area that had the history of the committee and brought together committees to implement. and work to the implementation. It involved travel. It involved putting on seminars and workshops throughout the state for students to attend and to learn not only more about the award process, but more about the area in which they are applying. The mathematics scholars of distinction have had, each of the committees operates in a different way because of the recommendations of their committees. But mathematics, the candidates are announced in the fall, and then the students work with the committee, actually, and they are brought together for three summits during the year. So students are coming from all over the state to attend two-day seminars in which the students have an opportunity to work and advise on their tractable problem that they're doing, and to interact with mathematicians at a number of different collegiate levels. And so all of this, of course, takes money. Theater arts the same way. They have brought together students and have had to give them opportunities for experiencing what the award is about, and they need to be reviewed depending on the area that they are applying in. In science, the majority of ours goes to outreach, to attending meetings, to going throughout the state, approaching students and their teachers, helping them to through workshops to understand excellence in science education, and helping students to be rewarded. I have a budget available here if you are interested.
Well, the summary was good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Would you give that copy of the budget to the page behind you? Because there are some other people who would like to see it also. And then could you just comment on the number of students, the actual students that are served in this program, and the
yeah.
number of coordinators that are employed?
I am a full-time employee, and the majority of my time and a secretary are paid for out of a sharing of all of the areas. There is a shared leadership in the area of theater arts, and they have a stipend, and they share that. There is a leader in mathematics, and since my job is also, I coordinate the science, but I also have been in charge of the task force. So we have had four other, part-time stipend leaders for the areas. I am the only full-time person.
So everybody else is a part-time
coordinator. That's correct. They're paid a flat stipend for, and a contract is made for their services.
And how many students are in this program?
Well, it changes by the minute. Currently, for example, in science, we have 30 applicants for this year's award. That may increase. The state science fair that is sponsored by the Minnesota Academy of Science and underwritten by the Department of Education is this weekend. And we have found over the last 3 years that after the state science fair, when students have gone through this process, we have a huge spike in the number of applicants for this. So we could have as many as 40 applicants in science alone. There were 19 applicants for the award in theater arts. There were 9 applicants in mathematics in their first year.
All right, thank you very much. Representative Erica, one more question for Ms. Newell.
Yes, okay. Thank you, Chair Sikora. Ms. Newell, did you say that 3M no longer funds the science scholars program?
3M, within the last 2 weeks, 3M has given us an invitation to apply for a $10,000 grant for this academic year. That's not a guarantee that we will receive it, but we've been invited to apply for it. They have been with us from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair, finally follow up.
Dr. Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. And Ms. Newell, how about in mathematics or the other areas, do you have corporate sponsors or the potential for corporate sponsors?
We have not. We have been actively seeking grants to support the prize money. And that is the thing that has caused us some anguish, actually, this year, is the operational support has been underwritten by the Department of Education. But under no circumstances may any of that money be used for prize money. So we have had to go to the corporate world and to the business world and our other stakeholders to seek support for the prizes for the students. There are cash awards that go with these. Prizes.
And Madam Chair, Representative Erickson. Thank you. One follow-up. How much are the cash awards?
There are two levels, Madam Chair, Representative. There are two levels in each of the areas. One is the Scholar of Distinction, which carries a $500 cash prize. And then there is Meritorious Performance, which carries a $100 prize.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Newell, given that you are the only full-time employee, I'm wondering if you would share with us your annual salary and benefits package in a very brief.
I am an employee, Madam Chairman. I am an employee of Minnetonka Public Schools, actually. I was the science coordinator for that district. And I work in academics. My job was sold, actually. I can't say I'm in bondage to 27, but they purchased my contract and have for the last 5 years for outreach work that I have done with the Scholars of Distinction program and another mathematics for young talented math kids called the Fermi Math Program. So my $60,000 salary has been underwritten by or purchased from and benefits have been purchased from District 27. I am still a Minnetonka employee and receive my paycheck from Minnetonka. District 27 purchases my services.
Thank you very much, Ms. Newell. All right. Sorry for that delay, Mr. Chaudhry. Please go ahead.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for letting me be here today. Why I'm here today is to convince you to fund the Scholars of Distinction program. That's pretty much my purpose. But you talk about you've increased funding for the AP and IB program, and that's great because this year I'm taking 4 AP tests myself, and I'm glad that the cost has been reduced for me. But why you should fund the Scholars of Distinction program is that because it reaches out to all students in all areas. I've been to Boise State this past summer, and I was able to meet a diverse array of students from different various locations, some from very small town communities who don't necessarily have AP or IB programs. What Scholars of Distinction does is it recognizes those students who are excelling in their area, who are in, as Fred Bouchard's book, The Student Leadership Hand Guide, which we are reading for the April 7th, Summit for the Scholars of Distinction states, are servant leaders, leaders to their communities, leaders who will serve their communities, who protect themselves first and then go out to protect others. These leaders need to be recognized in their academic and degree areas because, as we said, America is currently at a crisis right now. We need leaders in our forefront in pushing new innovations and designs. We've all seen the Ford commercial on TV where CEO Bill Ford comes in and talks about America needs new innovations and designs, but only by recognizing these leaders in this increasingly world where increasing opportunities are necessary because when you apply for college, they look for what stands out, what makes you unique. This is one of those programs. So currently, right now, I'm in District 287. I'm under the Mentor Connection program. And under my mentorship right now, I'm working on the Northwest bankruptcy case. Now, I know I'm only a high school student, but I still try to excel in the area that I want to pursue. I want to become a business lawyer, so I go out and excel beyond. But these students necessarily in the communities that I've, again, stated, they don't have the opportunities that I do. They don't have the transportation to get down here. They don't have the resources necessarily. But still doesn't mean that we can't recognize them for those achievements. That would be one of the greatest injustices that this committee could do is to stand silent and cut the funding for those students who are working hard, like myself and my fellow peers. And that's why I'm here today, pretty much to represent them. And also with that, I'd like to end with a quote from our nation's third president, Thomas Jefferson. I'm a great believer in luck. I find the harder I work, the more of it I have. Thank you.
That's a good one. More people ought to be aware of that one. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, my question is more toward some expenditures. So if there's others that have questions of the of the student, I guess that would be better first.
Did anybody have a question for Mr. Chaudhry? Seeing none, go ahead and address Mr. Newell.
Madam Chair, you know what? I will ask Mr. Chaudhry a question. If you could, then I'll come back to my other question, my original one.
And they say women change their minds.
I just added to mine, Madam Chair. I didn't change it. I think I'll just move on. This hole is getting deeper. Mr. Chaudhry, could you give us a very, and I think you maybe did, but give us an example of something that you did during the year that was in the arena of the Scholars of Distinction program that somebody else didn't have a chance to do.
Currently, on November 15th, as I've been working as, aside from Mentor Connection, I'm also a mentor at my high school. We started the program this year. I've been mentoring freshmen and also other mentors as my job as an executive mentor. With that, my counselors recognized my abilities and they invited me to this United Way Cross Dialogue sponsored in Bloomington City Hall, where to explain kind of diversity in the community. So I was like, yeah, sure, I'll go and attend. And I was figuring other high school students would be over there and meet my fellow classmates. I go over there, I realize there's only three high school students total, including myself. I'm the only high school student, senior high school student speaking at the event about my immigrant experience and how I emigrated from over here from Pakistan. I was born in Pakistan, lived there for 2 years. After that, I lived 7 years in New York, 7 years in Minnesota right now, and a semester in Michigan. And so I talked about my experiences and about them growing up. And I was able to build the stronger Bloomington community by simply saying my diversity and my customs. I'm also a Muslim in Minnesota, which is quite unique, I would like to say. I don't know. But personally, it's fun kind of meeting new friends and new people. And then after my cross dialogue, I was sponsored by the Bloomington Human Rights Commission to attend the Human Rights Convention, which commemorated the 50th anniversary of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And so that was also interesting about learning about various other things, such as human trafficking. So pretty much my part in this has been going around and speaking about diversity. And in fact, the United Way has invited me again on April 27th to speak in front of their staff about diversity training. So my idea is pretty much to speak about leadership and how community building is important and how to understand others. And so that's my part that I've been doing so far with the community.
Thank you, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have other classmates you're doing this with? Are you pretty much doing things individually? Group projects with the other Scholars of Distinction? Can you expand on that a little bit?
Mr. Chaudhry.
I won't be eligible for the Scholars of Distinction program right now. I'm a senior, so I'd be graduating for that. I'm just doing this because I feel like it's an excellent program that needs to be funded for. For the Scholars of Distinction program, I'm pretty sure there's many well-qualified candidates. In my Mentor Connection program alone, that is also done through District 287, we have a barrage of students, so I think maybe like 80-plus, who serve in various different career fields. Like I said before, I want to go into business law. I have a friend of mine who's doing cardiology, and his project that he's going to be working towards, just as a leadership person would be working towards, is a project in cardiology that will help benefit a better society, kind of being a servant leader, like I said before. And that's what Mentor Connection does, and so that's what this new Scholars of Distinction program is about. Students are, from what I hear from Ms. Newell, are expected to put in 300 service hours, come up with an annotated bibliography of those who they feel have shown leadership in the field that they want to go into, and also implement the new project that will help society. Along with that, they will also be focusing on their writing skills, which are essential no matter where you go, especially in college, because you're going to have to write, and fill up those blue books for those final exams. I'm just so eager to look forward to next year.
Mr. Chaudhry, how many students are actually from the rural part of the state? I couldn't tell from the earlier presentation. Do you know?
From the rural part.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Ms. Newell.
I don't know if Yaya is prepared to answer that.
All right. Good answer.
We have not a single mathematics candidate from the metro area. They are all from outstate. There is a growing trend with our outreach to expand the program. Next week's leadership conference, the very first, where we're kicking off the Scholars of Distinction in Leadership, will have 50 students from around the state. I would say a third of them are from the metro area. We are especially fortunate that I just received word yesterday that a delegation of 7 students will be coming from the Red Lake Reservation. So a great part of our work is the outreach. It's talking to students in all of the disciplines and helping them to come to understand that they can be recognized for the service that they're doing, for the exact or for the exquisite learning that they are doing above and beyond their standards.
So in all, you reach, I think I asked you this before, but we didn't really come up with a number. It looked like 50 to 60 students, or was that just in one area?
I would say at this point we have 60 students total among the program.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I'll go back to the first question I was going to ask.
All right.
I got fascinated with Mr. Chaudhry. Excellent job, by the way. My question relates to the estimated total budget sheet that we got here. Ms. Newell, was that from you?
Our working budget, as a matter of fact. That is how we have spent the money and are spending the money this academic year. That is the $300,000 that was granted to us by the Department of Education to bring all of the programs up to speed. We aren't seeking that much, I guess.
Madam Chair.
Last question, Representative Demmer.
Thank you. My question relates to the categories, contracted services, which are things like speakers, workshop services, travel and conferences, supplies, materials, non-instructional, and technology for outreach and course development. Just quickly looking at that, it appears to be roughly half the budget for those things. Are students involved in those things, or is that more for the contracted services and the travel? Who's doing the traveling, and who are the services that are being contracted for?
Ms. Newell.
Representative, Madam Chairman, it's a combination of both. It is both bringing students to events from around the state. For example, the math conferences have been in the four corners of the state, campus of UMD, St. Cloud, Southwest, and in Moorhead. And the students need to travel to each of those. So not only that, but the committees travel. In addition, we have some contracted services that are vital to this first year's work that will not be continued. We have we are in the third year of awarding grants in science, and so it is incumbent upon us to have an outside program review. So we have to budget money for an outside program reviewer. We are developing websites on each of these. We pay for website services at the Minnesota Academy of Science. Even though a portion of theirs is in kind, we still pay for the hosting of one of our websites there. All of these services that we have, we're having a documentary made. We're developing an online college course through North Star Online to bring leadership to both teachers and students around the state where they can access via online. And so the development of that course, the going around getting sound bites related to things, we're working on a video and we're working on promotional videos. All of those are contracted services with those. It seems like a large amount, but that's what the money was given to us for this academic year. We have until the 30th of June to complete our work with the $300,000 that was allocated for this project. Now what we seek is a modest amount to continue that work or to expand.
All right, thank you. We have one last question. I would ask the questioner and the responder to please be brief.
Ms. Newell, how many applicants can the program currently handle and how many awards do you give out?
Ms. Newell.
Madam Chair, we've taken what has come to us, frankly. We have we have asked for students to apply, and we have taken all of them. We haven't put a cap on it. The cap will be, I imagine, the amount of money that is raised to pay the awards. That is what the limiting factor is right now.
All right. Thank you very much. And
thank you.
Thank you for being here and for your excellent testimony.
Thank you.
And we're going to move along quickly now because we've burned about half of our program time. Representative Dorman, are you present? Thank you.
And this is the grants for increased heating and transportation costs due to our extremely cold winter. Excuse me, Representative, I couldn't help it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I apologize for showing up late.
I will move House File 3223 to be heard and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
2 days in a row, I'm going to probably get expelled if I lay the third time, I suppose. But before you today, we have House File 3223, and what this does is recognize some increased costs that our schools throughout the state are facing due to the increased costs of energy. And we all have them, whether it's in our house or our schools. It's just these folks have a little bit harder time than some others trying to figure out where they're going to get the dough from to pay for it. And you know, I'll kind of liken this a little bit to the bonding bill, Madam Chair and members. You know, it seems like there's always a push for that new project or that new spending. But it seems to me that we ought to, before we spend any new dollars, we ought to make sure that we're taking care of what we should be doing, our core functions first, before we expand into other programs. And so I know people have got ideas on how to spend money, and it's an election year, and we all want to have, gee, we're out doing this great new project. But I think that it's important that we also take care of our basics first. And so with that, I'll turn it over to the group on my immediate right, starting with Gray Schwab, who is with the Minnesota School Board Association. With a snazzy handout.
Ms. Schwab. That was familiar. I believe it's on my desk at the present time.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and members. Greg Schwab with the Minnesota School Boards Association. I put our handout from Monday. Hopefully you all have one of these. Our school board members went around and talked about the issues that were important to them. This really came on our agenda about November when, if you remember the headlines, they were predicting huge inflationary costs for schools and everyone, and gas and heating oil. The good news is the winter wasn't nearly as bad as we expected. Unfortunately, the bad news is prices are still at times double what they were. What I've done is I'm passing out to you right now a quick snapshot we took on Monday from school districts across the state. Cook County is the first one on top, just to get a feel of what have they seen to date in their school districts. Some of them were kind enough to provide their... I know I gave them to the page manager.
Yes, you have it, members.
Actually, a separate piece.
Oh, another piece?
Yeah, I've got... Madam Chairman, okay? Madam Chairman? Yeah, this one. And she just... Madam Chairman, I believe I gave the page plenty of copies. I'm not
Well, go ahead, Ms. Schwab.
I appreciate that, Madam Chairman. Thank you. Basically, this is just a Monday snapshot. I was curious about where we were in the stream of things. And you'll see that the real average that we could tell for those districts that provided us last year's data and this year was about a 24% increase. So I had asked Mr. Melcher earlier to look at O4 data to give us some background in which to look at this issue. He, by UFARS, went through the system, and that's what the second sheet has on it, and found there was about $190 million in utility costs and gasoline used across the state of Minnesota. We considered many different options in approaching this, knowing that some places like Ely have about a $75 per student increase because they have very long bus routes, and it's colder in northern Minnesota than it is in southern Minnesota. What we came up with is coming before you today asking for a one-time funding of $25 that basically is about a 13% increase for this year only, Madam Chairman. Because we could not react and had no anticipation in any of our budgets that the hurricanes were going to come forward. I know from next year we are anticipating an 11% increase, so we're going forward, doing the right things. We're looking at more energy efficiency. But truly for this year we're presently in, there was nothing we could have done to fix it. And it's just an unfortunate circumstance. We'd like to provide lots of programs, but we've got to pay our gas and our utilities. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kronquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and also coming around right now is a handout. And it's a copy of a survey that we conducted last fall asking our member school districts to try to project the increases they were looking at in terms of heating fuel cost increases and then transportation increases. And the survey was conducted in October and November, and so, you know, clearly if we took the survey over again right now, asked our member districts to do it again, obviously the numbers would look a little bit different. As the chair mentioned, we did have a milder than normal winter, and that certainly did help moderate those increases. Nonetheless, those increases at that time were being projected at 60% to 70%, which, you know, really was a crisis proportion. And the fact is, even the moderate winter has still left us with facing increases in the 30% to 40% range, which is still way more than anybody could have possibly budgeted for or would have thought possible when they set their budgets last spring, last May and June. And so we very much appreciate Representative Dorman bringing this bill forward, because it really would help adjust an unforeseen cost increase. The only other alternative, quite frankly, is that districts are going to spend down fund balances, or in fact, many of them have tried to make what adjustments they could make after the fact. And as you all know, that really is a limited number of areas where you can impact your budget once it's been set. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll stop, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Lundell. Thank you, Mr. Kunz.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell, Schools for Equity and Education. My members don't respond to surveys with the consistency that Mr. Kronquist does, so I can only give you anecdotal evidence. My survey got about a paltry one-third response rate, so I would say that, though, from that anecdotally, we're looking at probably about $50 a kid has been the average in our group as to what the increased need in these areas would be.
I'm sorry, Mr. Lundell, was that 15 or 50?
50.
And yours is that much higher than others?
Okay. Madam Chair, I would think that it may be due to mileage in many cases, that there was, again, as Ms. Kronquist was saying, that one thing that obviously can't be adjusted is the amount of a number of bus miles that people drive, especially with contracts and start times. Those types of patterns put in place, you're certainly going to have, if you have more transportation, you're probably going to see greater effects, greater cost effects there. There are some things you can do with heating and building closings, and I think that, or I should say, closing down of our closing down heat on the weekends. I know some schools have done that, but I think with school buses, obviously, we need to go the same route that we've gone in the past. We can't do anything this mid-year. But again, this is only anecdotal. I haven't gotten the scientific.
Hi. We have a question from Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Dorman, and you may certainly feel free to punt this question to some of the experts next to you, but I'm wondering why there was the choice to use resident marginal cost pupil units in the legislation, which of course includes students who attend chartered schools and those who might possibly open enroll. Why that was the calculating factor and not something like ADMs?
It's fourth and long, Madam Chair. I'm going to drop back and punt. After careful consideration.
And the answer would be coming from which of your stage managers over there, Representative Dorman?
Which of your receivers?
Yeah, which of your receivers?
Exactly.
Madam Chairman, Grace Fogel, Minnesota School Boards Association.
Okay.
I'm trying to catch that punt. Mr. Deans is the man who drafted it. If you pull the bill and look at the bill, the last line basically wanted to tie how you pay this to how you pay the general fund. So there was no idea that there was no intention to limit it at all. The run you're looking at was prepared for the Senate hearing by Mr. Nauman, and that's the way he calculated it. I don't find that language in the
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Schwab, if we are talking about House File 3223, then I direct your attention to page 1, line 9, and resident marginal pupil, resident marginal cost pupil units is the calculating factor. If you look at the run, Minneapolis's RMCPU is at over 51,000. However, they serve, close to or just under 40,000 students. So I'm kind of wondering why I caught that. I don't know. Maybe Senator Poldemiller didn't think we'd catch that. But.
Ms. Schwab.
Madam Chairman, I appreciate the Representative Biskin's catch there. It was my fault. I didn't read it through. We're certainly open to providing for all, and we just tried to find the most equitable way to do this. The dollar amount even isn't. I mean, if you figured out what $25 was against $190 million, we're asking for a 13% increase over last year. We just tried to find a fair and equitable way to do it. And as I said, the fact of the matter is we got to pay our gas and our utility bills before we get to anything else for kids. And that's why you speak in front of us. If Representative Biskin of the committee has a better way to do this.
Ms. Schwab, if we either need to adjust, I think, amend this to say per adjusted marginal cost pupil unit, or just say per pupil. We can't do that? Okay. We have to do adjusted.
Madam Chair?
Go ahead. No. Oh, Representative Dabney. I'm sorry. I thought it was Mr. Kronquist.
Looking at Representative Biskin's question, perhaps a question to, I guess I'll move right on to Ms. Schwab. Since Representative Biskin's pointed out, the adjusted marginal cost pupil unit includes students going to chartered schools. This bill covers transportation increases as well. Doesn't state law mandate that regular public schools provide free transportation to students in charter schools, so it's the school district that would experience the cost in this? Can you help me with that, Ms. Schwab?
Ms. Schwab.
Madam Chairman, I'm definitely out of my depth on this one. Mr. Crow is probably the right person to ask on what is the appropriate reference to.
We're mixing sports metaphors tonight.
I think we'll go to Mr. Strong.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney. The charter school essentially is in the position to choose, but it has to request. Some charter schools do choose to have the public school district where they're located provide transportation services. Others provide that service themselves. So it depends. There's a mix here in the metro area. About a third of the charter schools provide their own transportation. About two-thirds rely on the school district where they're located.
Madam Chair, Mr. Strong, then it does seem like the adjusted marginal cost pupil unit, at least on average, would get to more of the issue of transportation costs for charter students, at least in the metro area, from what you're saying then.
Mr. Strong.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I, in terms of the transportation costs, that'd be my guess in the metro area, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Clancy.
Mr. Strom, does resident marginal cost per pupil unit include PSEO students, and does it also include homeschool students?
Madam Chair, Representative Clancy, it
Mr.
does include
Strom.
The PSEO count. It's essentially the count of all those students resident in a school district, regardless of where they attend in the public system. It would not include the children who are either in private school or homeschool. So, in other words, the resident marginal cost is the our pupil unit is the count of kids prior to them open enrolling in another district or choosing a charter school. And so the resident count does not include those that go to non-publics or are otherwise not in the public system. But if they're in the public system under resident, it counts where they reside, not where they're served. If you used adjusted marginal cost pupil unit, that would be the public institution that serves them, whether it's a charter school or PSEO or a school district.
I do believe that we should. Would you like to incorporate that into your bill, Representative Dorman? That should be really readjusted.
Yes.
So all of those in favor of changing resident to adjusted, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Thank you very much. Are there any further questions on this bill?
Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just was wondering if there's any breakdown as far as the increased costs and how it affects different regions of the state, because it seems the more remote, sparsely populated regions, obviously, it's going to cost more for the heating and transportation costs in those areas. So the increases are going to be greater there as well. And so first I was wondering, I guess, if there is any breakdown, and secondly, if you have considered, basing it not just on a per pupil basis, but basing it on the actual cost increase per pupil.
You mean go through each district, Mr. Eakin, and look at the real cost per pupil in each district?
Well, I'm not, Madam Chair, talking about each district, but regionally, looking at the different regions and breaking it down at least by, the more remote rural regions as opposed to the regions.
Okay, I understand now. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, didn't we try something like that this morning?
Touche. All right. Thank you very much. This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Mr. Heidgerken, Representative Heidgerken, would you like to chair the meeting while my bill is heard, please?
No, thank you.
Representative Eric.
Chair, I have made a promise I had never take a gavel, so thank you.
Who'd you make that silly promise to, Representative?
Where are my campaign promises?
Welcome to the testifying table, Representative Sakura.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And would you like to move your bill, please?
Yes, I think this is a fairly simple thing, Representative. This is House File 3501. I'd like to move it for consideration for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Sakura moves House File 3501 for possible inclusion in the K-12 omnibus bill. And you have an amendment, I understand? Would you like to... Actually, it's a delete-all, so I'm premature. Right. We better do your delete-all.
I don't know. Is there a delete-all in fact? I guess I just pull it out. Yes, I will. I will do it as a delete-all amendment. And move the delete-all amendment to 3501.
Okay. Well, the record show, please, that Representative Sakura moves the delete everything amendment for 3501. To put her bill in the order she wants it. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, say aye, please.
Aye.
Representative Sakura, your bill is now in the order in which you want to present it. Please go ahead and explain the bill.
Madam Chair, what this bill does is it affects intermediate districts and the special education tuition payments, which were part of the language that was changed last year. So I will just go directly to Mr. Larson, if he will. It's pretty simple, actually.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Larson. Please give your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bill Larson. I'm the superintendent of Intermediate School District 917. As members know, I'm sure there are three intermediate school districts in the metropolitan area, the only three in the state. And essentially, I'm representing the point of view of all three of those intermediate school districts. Representative Sakura mentioned the change in the special education tuition billing that came out as a result of action of the legislature in the last session. This is a fundamental change in the way the data and the information is collected from school districts by the state, and the way that special ed reimbursements and fees are paid ultimately by the state rather than various districts exchanging bills and invoices and money between one another. This is going to be a fundamental change for all school districts and a relatively difficult one to implement. For the intermediate districts, it is profoundly more difficult to implement based upon the nature of the service that we provide and the type of students that we provide those services to. And as you may or may not know, most of our business is in low-incidence special education. For my district, that accounts for about 78% of all revenues are bills that we submit to other school districts for the special education services that we provide. Our other revenue comes through our area learning center and our secondary technical center, consisting of the other 22% of our revenue. For most K-12 districts, their special education revenue is probably something in the range of 20 to 25%, of which a very small amount is as the result of a third-party billing to another school district. In our situation, with 78% of our revenue coming from that source and 100% of that revenue as a result of tuition billing to other districts, it really compounds the problem for us. Another fundamental difference between the way the intermediate districts operate and regular K-12 districts operate their special education programs, a typical school district would find a classroom pure, if you will, set of students, a heterogeneous grouping of students in that program. So if you have a LD classroom, all of those students are LD. It's very easy to code them as LD for reimbursement or billing purposes. In our situation, most of our classrooms have multiple primary disabilities. For example, we have a transition program for the 17 to 21-year-old students. We have 8 different primary disabilities among the 65 students in that program. In the past, the billing has been by cost to the program. So we can take our transition costs and divide our costs by the number of student hours in that program and bill the resident districts the appropriate amount based upon the service that we provide. Now that billing will be based upon primary disability, so an LD student in that classroom might cost $8 an hour, whereas a EBD student in that classroom might cost $25 an hour. In the past, they were both billed at the same rate. So this is going to be a difficult process for us to collect data and a difficult result for our member districts to rely on paying the bills. It's going to be a fundamental change for them and going to be quite a difficult process for them to go through and do their own due diligence and make sure they're paying for services that are appropriate and that they actually received. We have another difference in intermediate districts. For a regular ed district, if there's a problem with this billing and the revenue does not flow the way it is expected to because of the complexity of the change that we're making, they have a large general education budget to fall back on and be able to provide them with cash flow to continue operating. The intermediate district has no general education budget to fall back on, except for that small amount that we would have in our ALC and secondary technical center budget. We also have no ability to raise money. A regular district can sell levy or aid anticipation revenue certificates to provide them cash flow in the short term to keep the operation going. Intermediate districts have no such authority and run a great risk of essentially running out of cash. To make a very perfect storm out of this, the low point in our cash position annually is in the summertime, the very time that we're going to be struggling with implementation of the new system. This is a problem that we have struggled with along with the department since midsummer. We've had numerous meetings with Dr. Melcher and his staff to try to resolve some of the issues and problems and better understand how we're going to be able to implement this system. A week ago, we met with Commissioner Segrin, Dr. Melcher, and others, and basically trying to make our case to delay the implementation for the intermediate districts so that we would have time to better address the issues, learn from the other districts of how they've solved the problems, and move on with it. We had had a bill drafted, which was unacceptable to the department, but with Mr. Melcher's help, the bill that you have before you as the new bill was drafted to conform with some of the concerns that the department had about our delay. The result of this bill doesn't just delay us. It allows us to delay implementation, but during the process of the delay, there are certain requirements placed upon us by this bill at the bottom of the page numbered 1, 2, and 3, to demonstrate that we're making progress towards solving these problems and being able to implement the new process after the FY08 year. That essentially is the description of what this bill would do. I am here with my business manager, Nicole Rausch, and if you have any questions, if I can't answer them, I'm sure she can.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Are there questions for Mr. Larson or Ms. Rausch? Mr. Larson, how many students will this impact? Do you know?
I can give you a number. It's a fuzzy number, and it's a fuzzy number because most of our students are not full-time students. We probably provide services something in the range of 2,000 students, but many of those might be receiving 3 hours a week of speech therapy or something of that nature. If you condense them all together, it's something in the range of 700 FTEs.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Sikora.
I would just like to make sure the committee understands that this has all been worked out with the department.
Yes.
They understand how difficult this is. And so we're using this procedure to gradually figure out how to get this done in a way it should be done.
Thank you, Representative Sikora. It is good that it has met with the stakeholder and the department to work out the bugs. And I think we all appreciate that. Are there any other questions from members? Hearing none, thank you, Representative Sikora. Your bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Eastland. And guests, please come forth. And I will move House File 3543 to be considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Eastland, welcome. And if you'd like to explain your bill, we'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a fairly simple fix from some legislation that we did last year that dealt with how special education co-ops could recover some of their costs. And basically, if you look at the bill, I believe it's slide 235, there was a list of the kinds of organizations that special education districts take that can apply for this reimbursement. And there was one type of organization that was left off, and that was a school district that served as an applicant agency for a group of school districts for federal special education aid for fiscal year 2006. What we did is we just we added that type of organization, and we put in the year 2006 so no one else can organize that way into the future. I have with me two people that can testify and answer questions today, and one of them is Mary Ruprecht. She is the Special Ed Director at Rum River Co-op, which is at Cambridge, Minnesota, and the other is Nan Records. And she is a Special Ed Director from Monticello, the Sherburne Northern Wright County Special Ed Co-op, and this legislation affects both of those districts as well as a number of other school districts: Cloquet, Rush City, Brainerd, Alexandria, Park Rapids, Grand Meadows, Faribault, and Waseca. So there's a number of districts that would appreciate getting this little fix done. It would expedite, I think, their concern that that they'll be able to get the reimbursement they need from the districts that are hosting their services. So I'd like to just turn the mic over to Mary Ruprecht from Cambridge. And before she speaks, I guess I'd like to say Nan Records, just for information here, is the National Special Education Director of the Year. And she's going to be getting her award in Utah next week. So we have some important people here.
She did that. I know she did.
My name is Mary Ruprecht. I'm the Director of Special Education for the Rum River Special Ed Cooperative that is hosted by the Cambridge Isani District School District. Cambridge Isani serves as a fiscal host for the cooperative, and what Representative Eastland is telling you is that the fiscal hosts, there are only about 10 of us in the state that are still left over, were excluded from the waiver process that allowed districts to appeal to the commissioner when the tuition billing legislation takes effect next year and the state takes over tuition billing. We would not be able to seek a waiver if we weren't able to get our expenditures back for our host programs. For instance, Cambridge Isani hosts a very large day treatment program, and brings in students from all of our member districts. And in the past, we've been able to just keep those expenditures separate from all of the other expenditures of the Cambridge ISD district, and then we were able to bill the actual expenses. So with the new tuition billing process, we just want to be sure that we are able to get those expenditures back from the rest of the districts whose students that we provide programs for. And we're just asking to be included, along with the ed districts, the joint powers cooperatives, and the intermediate districts in that waiver process. Yes,
and please introduce yourself for the record.
Nan Records, Director of Special Education for Sherbourne Northern Rights Special Ed Co-op. So I serve the districts of Becker, Big Lake, Monticello, and St. Michael Albertville. And Monticello serves as the host district, the fiscal host of our cooperative, and has since its beginning of time back in the early 70s. And we're a unique co-op in that we have, geographically, we're very close, and we do have a number of co-op employees. Approximately 110 employees are employed by the co-op, yet our paychecks say Sherbourne or say Monticello School District. And our difficulty is, just like Mary explained, we're not sure, and like the former superintendent up here talked about the challenges of the state taking over this process, we're not sure how it's going to look. We're not sure what those rates are going to come out to be. They may capture all that is out there for our co-op programs, but if they don't, we want to be able to have the opportunity, like the ed districts, the intermediate districts, and the joint powers co-ops, to have that opportunity to make an appeal to the commissioner to say the process didn't capture all of our actual costs. In addition to my concern about the appeal processes, I'm also concerned as a fiscal host that Monticello cash flow will be affected by this. Right now they're projecting that the cash would flow into back into the host district of Monticello starting in January. Well, we, like I said, we employ about 110 employees. Monticello is a district that's cutting about $1.2 million next year. They're not going to have the capability, even though they're unlike an intermediate district, they do have general revenue, they're not going to have the capability to cash flow those 110 employees for those co-op services until the dollars start flowing from the department. And so it's a twofold concern for me, the cash flow and the ability to do the appeals process. So, thank you.
All right. Are there any questions for the witnesses? First of all, Representative Eastland, I would ask you, as I think in this case it's important, whether or not you have worked at all with the department on this language, whether they are aware of it and accepting of this idea.
Yes, Madam Chair. I spoke with Mr. Melcher just actually before the hearing and asked him if the department was going to take a position, and he said, no, they do not have a position. If he wants to come up and speak to that, he can.
Then are there any questions for any of the witnesses or Representative Eastland?
Yes.
Representative Clinton.
Thank you. I just have a question about how host district is being defined, and is it being constrained in this proposal to, is it being limited, I guess, to just those who are host districts before 2006, or could someone apply, could a district apply to become a host district now and be and fall under this law?
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was the concern that the department originally had, that we make sure that this is a grandfather type of a waiver that we're providing here. And so that's why they had to be operating in 2006 under this structure to be able to qualify for this. No new co-op can organize this way and be granted these kind of reimbursement rights.
Any further questions? Hearing none, thank you very much, all of you. And this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We are going to move on then to our next bill, Representative Kelleher. And I will move House File 3577 before the committee and ask Representative Kelleher to explain her bill, please. Is there an amendment to this one? students. Representative Kelleher, you have an amendment?
I do, Madam Chair.
Okay.
If we could do that right away. The amendment will put it in line with the forecast, I believe, the February forecast.
All right. Having heard an explanation of the amendment, all those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, amendment is adopted. All right, Representative Kelleher, tell us what
Madam Chair, members, thank you so much for hearing this bill. It's a very important bill since special education mandate is one of the largest, if not the largest, unfunded mandate that school districts face. And as you are all aware, this is one of the areas where pressure has been growing ever since, it's been growing for a long time, but particularly since 2003, when the legislature, at the request of the governor, froze the special education funding. And so I want to go through quickly what the bill does. It restores the special education growth factor eliminated in the 2003 legislature and it because of needing to balance the budget. In effect, restoring the 4.6 inflationary growth rate to the regular special education formula. It amends the statutory appropriation caps by increasing them to reflect the annual growth rate numbers. And, of course, you all know this is very important. This affects every district in the state. It does not pick winners and losers. It certainly also responds to the fact that since 2001, there has been over 20% increase in the cross-subsidy of special education by regular funding. And, of course, you all here on the Education Finance Committee know how cross-subsidy works, that when there's not enough money in the regular special education formula, then it needs to be cross-subsidized by the regular education formula. And so that's how we end up with what we call cross-subsidy. That has been growing. The bill really thaws the freeze and restores the statutory inflation factor that was eliminated, and I think would be a very good step for us to take in terms of dealing with this issue. I have a couple testifiers with me today, and I know that you have one more bill to go before the end of your committee time, so I think it would be important to hear from them as well. Today I have with me Tom Hegarns, who is the Special Education Director for the Minneapolis School District, and I also have with me testifier Ms. Jamie Taylor, who would like to testify for you as well today, and then maybe we could open it up to questions. I don't know if that's how you usually do things.
That's how we usually do it.
Okay, great.
Nothing real unusual here.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Hegarns? Hegarns? Yes. Which is it?
It's Hegarns.
Hegarns. Whoa, I was nowhere close.
I got it really wrong.
Okay.
It is Norwegian.
Ah. Oh, well, that explains it.
That explains it. I'm the director of special education for Minneapolis Public Schools, but I think this certainly is an issue that touches all the school districts in the state. While the federal government is cutting the amount of subsidy and support of special education and demanding more from us, we at the same time are faced with increasing costs of more and more complex students. Certainly, one of the issues is, I'm sure many of you have heard the number of autism students that are erupting from our midst. It's just a worldwide phenomenon. What we are seeing is a lot of students who are more and more expensive to support. And this cross-subsidy that rears its head every year in Minneapolis, certainly in other places as well, what it does is that not only does it force us to limit services to our students, our special ed students, but it also has a more profound effect in that as a principal in a building just a few years ago, I was cutting things like band and world languages because the cross-subsidy from the general ed fund. The other thing I like to tell you is that one of the things and the questions I get from Minneapolis is since you are losing students, we have last year we lost 3,000 students. We're doing what we can to change that trend, but in the meantime, you'd expect that we would lose a proportionate amount of special ed students. We do not. We lose a portion to what the students that are in general ed compared to special ed. We lose about half as many special ed students that you'd expect. The special ed students stay. They are more expensive. What we're seeing is a rise in the complexity of the students. The cheapest, for want of a better word, students that we serve are ones in a resource service where we have students that are pulled from regular classrooms, given some tutoring sorts of support by a teacher who may serve up to 20, 25 students. This number of students is going down. What's going up is the number of students that require several hours of service per day, separate classrooms, even separate buildings. So the complexity, the needs of our students is rising dramatically, lack of growth factor, it just adds to the amount of the cross-subsidy, which keeps pressing us between, I guess, a rock and a hard place. And I would ask you to consider restoring that growth factor in the special ed funding. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hegrinus.
Very well done.
And Jamie Taylor.
Hello, and thank you for letting me testify, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jamie Taylor, and I'm a soon-to-be graduate, Master's of Education graduate in the field of deaf education. I am also deaf-blind and have received special education services from K through 12 in the state of Minnesota. I would like to say simply and put forward, I would not be here without special education, and special education services are necessary to enable students to become successful. Put it simply and forthwith, in 1987, thereabouts, so a little while ago, when I was placed in general education kindergarten classroom with 20 other students, and I was receiving absolutely no help, and it was just abysmal. I wasn't learning anything, really, except how to pass with my scissors. And for 1 year, I wasn't learning anything. And then the school decided I should be placed in a classroom or school for children with developmental disabilities or cognitive disabilities because I wasn't learning anything. They didn't know how to teach me. They didn't know how to support me. But my mom knew better in her heart and in her mind that that wasn't adequate. And she fought. And finally, the school district decided, okay, we're going to provide her with the education. But want to know what they asked that? You're expecting too much from her. And anyway, after I got the appropriate services from the teacher of the deaf and hard of hearing, I actually started to grow, and she knew I couldn't use phonics, the reading program, and she used other methods, which are tailored specifically to deaf and hard of hearing students to help me. And one of the projects was a sugar cube castle. And she taught me about some bloody dungeons and the snobby rich people. And anyway, it just fueled my interest. And from that, I wrote a story. And that was one of the things that I learned how to read and write from. And from there on, with her support and so many others, such as Braille, a teacher of the blind and visually impaired to learn Braille, an orientation and mobility instructor, I just got to the point right now where I can advocate for myself and for all the students in Minnesota with disabilities who I hope you will agree should not have to be forced to listen to the comments of public school education and teachers who are forced to ask students you're expecting too much from your students? Is it too much to ask that there be enough funding so that teachers be able to teach students, including ones? I received Paulette services, and in high school I was in the mainstream classroom. So with help it's possible, but large classrooms don't always work for all students.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'd just like to say that I think Jamie is a great success story of what our schools can do working together with parents and students and great teachers in Minnesota. My own daughter received early childhood special ed services and received early childhood speech education services for the first 2 years of her schooling. You would never know that today talking to Frances Kelleher, and she exceeds all marks in the Minneapolis public school system in terms of where she performs as a third grader. I think we have every range of student in our schools who need special ed and who are identified as so, but we do shortchange both our special education students and our regular education students when we do not provide the funding that's needed to provide adequate services. We grow the class sizes of our regular students, our mainstream students, to the point that the pressure is so great that we hear the cry over here at the Capitol. This is one way that I think your committee could act this year to really begin to reverse that.
Thank you, Representative Kelleher. And I see no other questions. Nobody on the list, right? So thank you very much for your presentation and your excellent testimony. Ms. Taylor, you did a wonderful job. Thank you very much. And we have only one. By the way, your bill will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
We have one other tiny item of business. Do we have minutes? You might want to peek at your minutes, but we also have before us House File 3744, which we essentially heard and laid over, but I think we'll just send this one on to the floor. It's been heard in Ways and Means already, and we'll just move it to the floor and not spend any time on it. This is the forecast. So I think you're pretty familiar with what's in the forecast. So I would move that we send that House File 3744 be passed and sent to the General Registry. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much. The bill will be passed on. And then if you will look at your wonderful minutes. I think our folks up here do a wonderful job of the minutes every day. And Representative Heidgerken, I saw that you looked like you wished to move the minutes.
Thank you. Sure do. Thank you, ma'am.
Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. And this meeting is adjourned, and we will meet again on Tuesday. I presume that there will first be session. So just be here as quickly as you can, because we have bills coming to us now from other places, and we have a lot to hear. Thank you.